This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. You may have lots of friends on Facebook, but are you friends with Facebook? It's been 15 years since a Harvard student named Mark Zuckerberg co-created the social network in his dorm room. But like many teenagers, it's prone to misbehave and worry the grown-ups. Some of you seem to expect Facebook to implode before it turns sweet 16. Here's a sample of what you left in our inbox.
My name is T. Reed Richards. My wife Kyla and I are from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we have ended our relationship with Facebook just due to the negativity, the false narratives, and so it doesn't seem to make our lives any better.
This is Darcy from South Bend. About 5 years ago, I gave Facebook a reluctant try, and just as I expected, I hated it. I found myself spiraled into the black hole of losing time enjoying my own life while I was reading what was going on with other people's lives.
I'm John from Birmingham. My relationship status with Facebook is as distant as possible. I use the Messenger app for coordinating groups, but I stay off of the main platform entirely. And it's because while Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and other companies, they sell user data in order to make an advertising dollar, Facebook does it so badly. They are just in the news every other week about how they have abused their consumers' trust. And at some point, you got to know when to walk away. And I think the consumer base has spoken, and we're walking away from Facebook, or at least I am.
Now, no one intended Facebook to cause the problems that it's caused. Not Zuckerberg, not the engineers, not the early investors, or its advisors. One former advisor is telling his story of how the company changed the world in unexpected ways and, in his view, refused to do right by its users in times of trouble. Joining us in studio is Roger McNamee, a former mentor to Mark Zuckerberg and an early investor in Facebook. His new book is called Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. Roger, welcome to 1A.
Joshua, it is so much fun to be here.
By the way, we did ask Facebook to provide someone for this conversation. No one responded in time for our broadcast, but the invitation stands. Let's begin with how your relationship with Mark Zuckerberg began. How did you meet him?
So, Joshua, imagine this. I started investing in technology in 1982 when the space program was the thing that was happening. So by the time Mark started Facebook, I'd been doing technology investing for 22 years. I met him for the first time in 2006. He was 22 years old. One of his colleagues called me up and said, Roger, my boss is facing a crisis. He needs to talk to somebody who is objective and not conflicted and is a dinosaur who can give him good perspective. That turned out to be me. I met Mark in my office, and he comes in classic Mark costume. And I say, before anything happens, I say, Mark, you got to let me tell you something. I said, if it hasn't happened already, Facebook is such an attractive business. Either Microsoft or Yahoo's going to try to acquire you for $1 billion. He had $9 million in revenues at that time, so $1 billion would have been a huge number. I said, they're going to try to acquire you for $1 billion. Everybody you know is going to tell you to take the deal. I think you've created the most interesting company since Google. I think you're going to be huge. It's going to be very successful. If I were you, I would recognize you won't get to do this a second time. Keep it independent. It turned out that's why he was there to see me that day. And that began a 3-year mentorship where, in many ways, I just advised him on a narrow set of business issues. He had lots of other mentors at the same time. But I was able to introduce him to somebody important in his life, Sheryl Sandberg, who became the COO.
So you connected Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg.
That's true.
What was it about Facebook that you saw at the time that encouraged you to encourage him to stay independent?
So Mark was an extraordinary young man. The meeting, which I describe in the book, was characterized by the longest silence I've ever had in a one-on-one meeting. If you've ever sat with one other person in a conversation and they don't talk for 15 seconds, it gets uncomfortable. He went for almost 5 minutes and I thought I was going to die because he was trying to decide if he trusted me, right? This is after I tell him the thing before he tells me, well, here's the deal, man. You know, they've offered, that's the thing you're talking about has happened. So Facebook had two things that made it unique. First is They had something that felt like authenticated identity. You could only be a member with an email address from a university, a high school, or a certain small set of businesses. Everything we knew about large networks said that anonymity was the secret to creating trouble. It's what allows bullies to take over and trolls. He had solved that problem. He also gave people legitimate control of their privacy. Those are two things that he later on, after I stopped being involved, he relaxed those things and got rid of them, and that is where the problem came from.
Before we get into the problems, we should note that your advice, at least on a dollars and cents level, was wise. If he had taken that billion-dollar buyout, he may well have become very wealthy. Just looking at the stock price right now, Facebook's market cap is $479 billion, the total value of all of the outstanding shares of Facebook, almost a half trillion dollars today.
So Joshua, get this. I looked at this. I thought it was going to be as successful as Google was then. I went back after that meeting. I told my partners, this thing's going to be huge. I think they can get to 100 million users. Right now, they're
just 100 million.
They're now at 2.5 billion. But in retrospect, I'm like Dr. Evil in the Austin Powers movie, 100 million. But in those days, that would have been such a humongous success. And at 100 million, he wouldn't have hurt anybody.
What was the first sign, in your view, that something wasn't quite right with Facebook on a deeper level, the infrastructure, the algorithm? Were there any early warning signs?
There were two early warnings that I did not weight heavily enough. The first was a product they had called Beacon in 2008 that essentially followed you in the real world. And whenever you made a purchase on a credit card in the real world, it would report it on Facebook. And the scandal blew up because a young man bought an engagement ring on Overstock or one of the other discount sites, and Facebook put it on his feed, and that's how his fiance found out he was going to propose. Everybody he knew found out about it, and they posted not just what he'd bought, but where he bought it and what he paid. And of course, that was a disaster. And it was a massive invasion of privacy because no one had any ability to control it. They didn't know Facebook was going to do that. They overreached so far. They were slapped back. The product was withdrawn after months.
What made Facebook think that was a good idea?
Well, Mark believes, and he's very idealistic about this, but he believes that connecting the whole world on one network is such a good idea for humanity that it justifies whatever means are necessary to get there. And so what has been revealed in the last 2 years is a whole series of things. But at the time, Beacon was the first time you could really see that kind of bad behavior.
Let's talk about the presidential election. You reached out to Mark Zuckerberg and to the COO, Sheryl Sandberg, about a week and a half before the 2016 election. As I understand it, you were concerned about the way that data could be used, as we now know, to try to influence the election. How did they respond when you raised this red flag?
So the background on this was that I had stopped being actively involved in Facebook in 2009. I just became a cheerleader. I was so proud of this company because it appeared that everything was going incredibly well. And then at the beginning of 2016, I saw a series of things. First, related to the Democratic primary, where I saw Facebook groups that looked inauthentic. And then there's a company that was using Facebook's advertising tools to gather data on people who were interested in Black Lives Matter, and they were selling it to police departments. And then Brexit happened in the United Kingdom. It's the referendum on whether to leave the European Union. And there it appeared to me the outcome was such a shock and the swing so far that maybe Facebook had played a role by essentially enabling inflammatory messages to outperform neutral messages. And then finally, the Department of Housing and Urban Development cited Facebook because its advertising tools enabled discrimination in the housing market in violation of the Fair Housing Act. And I'm going, these things, there's only one possible explanation. There's something wrong with the business model and the algorithms. And so I wrote an op-ed to complain about this. But instead of publishing it, I sent it to Mark and Sheryl. Their response was, Roger, we really appreciate you reaching out, but seriously, these things are just isolated. We've taken care of all of them. Nothing to see here.
I want to hear more about the turning point after they realized there was something to see when we continue in a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you, and you are listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Babbel. Have you always wanted to speak a new language? Whether it's for travel, work, or brain training, Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons will get you speaking confidently in your new language. Choose from Spanish, French, and more. You'll learn through real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers. And Babbel's spaced repetition method actually makes you remember what you've learned. Download the app or go to Babbel, Babbel.com to try Babbel for free.
When's the last time you had a really good workout? Not of your biceps, but of your brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain. Listen every week and flex your mind.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the impact of Facebook on our democracy, our privacy, and our personal data. Roger, the title of the book, Zucked. What do you mean by that?
I allow the reader to decide what it means to them.
Because it sounds a little naughty.
Well, you know, that's in your mind, and I'll let you go there if you wish.
That's my dirty mind.
That's your dirty mind, Joshua. So my lovely wife, Anne, came up with the title. I mean, it's really hard to name anything. And in book publishing, as with rock and roll bands, the shorter the name, the more powerful the idea. And this is also kind of funny.
Hey, our name is two characters. It's a one and an A. So
yeah. And you got the Twitter handle, right? So
exactly.
That's what it's all about. And so the term Zucked was in the vernacular, in the Urban Dictionary and all that. And it just seemed to me that I'm trying to get people to wake up and recognize that their lives are being affected, even if they don't use Facebook or Google. Right? These guys are a massive surveillance business, and they control a lot of things we don't know about. Zucked seemed like a good way to get people's attention.
I almost forgot to ask you, Roger, you were an early investor in Facebook. Are you still invested in Facebook?
I am. I made a conscious choice that I didn't want anyone to think that my activism had a financial end, like sinking a stock. So I have held on to a huge position in Facebook. It's by far my largest investment. My theory is I'm going to suffer from my activism alongside everybody else, because my goal isn't to hurt Facebook. My goal is to change their business practices and their business model. And I feel like as someone who participated and benefited on the way up, I should be there with them as long as I'm speaking out.
I appreciate the transparency. I imagine also it gives you a little bit more of an in because you are an investor. You know, you're able to have a say at the table as a shareholder, speaking through proxy. Like, it should give you...
You would think so. But in America, we now live in a time where capitalism is in this really extreme position. And companies like Facebook and Google, the founders have complete voting control. Nobody at Facebook has talked to me since February 2017, and I haven't heard from Mark and Sheryl since the 30th of October of 2016. It is remarkable. I'm having to do my communications with them on 1A.
Now, couldn't it be argued with regards to the impact of Facebook, and I want to get more into the potential dangers, Facebook is something that we choose to engage with. If you don't like what's on Facebook, you can ignore a profile, you can block a profile, you can log off, you can delete an account and just disengage with Facebook. What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that in principle, but let me explain what's really going on. The business of Facebook is getting you to look at ads. In order to do that, they need to manipulate your attention so you spend more time. In order to do that, they appeal to the weakest parts of the human psyche, and there are three things they do in particular. They appeal to our fundamental need for rewards with notifications and like buttons and things like that. But they also appeal to fear and outrage, because fear and outrage are contagious. So people share a lot, and it gets people to spend a lot of time, because when you're either afraid or angry, you want other people to be afraid and angry too. And so when they're using their algorithms, they tune them for those three things. And that creates habits, because the notifications and likes bring us back, and the habits can evolve into addictions. And when you are addicted, and a meaningful portion of Facebook's audience is addicted, then you can be manipulated. And here's the test I say to people. You know, they say, hey, how do I know if I'm addicted? I go, okay, how early in the morning do you check your phone? Is it before you pee or while you're peeing? Because I don't know anybody who waits until after they're done. Right,
and I mean, as you say that, my Apple Watch just vibrated, and I'm trying so hard not to look down.
One of the ways I advise people to make their life better is to turn off the notifications. You can get them, but don't let them interrupt what you're doing.
I agree with that. I have started turning off notifications for Twitter at the very least. And like when I think to check Twitter, then I check it. And my heart is still beating. I am just fine.
And it's remarkable. You discover, oh yeah, there are human beings in the world. I mean, Joshua, I was as addicted as any human being on earth. At one time, I carried 7 mobile devices on my body all the time. I mean, I looked like I had a utility belt on, like Batman.
Like Batman, yeah.
Yeah, just like Batman. And the thing is, I was a full-time tech investor, so there was some branding benefit and all that from it. But my whole life was mediated by technology.
Well, but whose responsibility is that? I mean, is it Facebook's responsibility to control the way people behave online?
No, I'm actually very sensitive to that point. What I'm saying here is it's not a fair test because you make the first move. You get on there and you start using it. But after that, they are doing everything in their power to manipulate your attention. And once you are addicted, your ability to control is much less. I mean, think about people with gambling addictions. That's the directly analogous thing. They don't have the full ability to control their own things. And remember, they say you choose the people you follow, you choose the things you click on, but they control the menu. They edit. There are literally a million things, Joshua, that could be in your feed at any point in time. They pick the 20 that are best for their business, not best for you. So my simple point here is not that you don't have any responsibility, but the notion that they are free of blame here is laughable.
How directly can we draw a causal connection between Facebook and the treatment of Rohingya Muslims, between Facebook and the UK pulling away from the European Union?
So here's what I would say. First of all, it's about all of us being aware and getting involved and speaking out. So relative to the Rohingya, if you don't know about this story, we're talking about Myanmar, the former Burma in Asia, country of 50 million people. They had no telecommunications infrastructure and no media until Facebook persuaded the government to lower the price of cell phones in exchange for Facebook providing an internet infrastructure that was a simplified form of Facebook. What happened was the leading Buddhist monks and the military decided to wage a hate speech war against the very tiny Rohingya minority in that country. And the people in the country had no experience with news, much less with disinformation. So they believed it. And the result, according to the United Nations, was a, quote, classic ethnic cleansing, unquote. 9,000 people were killed, confirmed. And 42,000 people are missing and presumed dead. Now, the United States, I believe, lost 56,000 soldiers in Vietnam in 10 years. This is potentially 51,000 in 6 months. And the United Nations cited Facebook specifically, and only Facebook, for having enabled this. Because Facebook is the internet. It is all media.
What is your sense of how Facebook views, just to carry that example further, views, say, the tragedy of the Rohingya Muslims? Does the company feel some responsibility? I don't want to presume how close you are with the inner workings of the company today, but what's your sense of the company's sense of accountability?
Let me give you an example in the United States. So a few years back, they introduced a product called Facebook Live that allowed anybody who was on Facebook to film something and broadcast it to all their friends. Some guy put on Facebook Live and went and killed somebody and broadcast the killing. Afterwards, one of the senior Facebook executives wrote an all-hands memo in which he said, this kind of stuff is going to happen. It is, and I'm paraphrasing here, it is a cost of achieving our growth objectives. You see, I think Mark and the company believe that the objective of connecting the whole world on one network is so virtuous, so obviously the right thing to do, that it justifies any means necessary to get there. And so it's not that they don't, you know, that they ignore the plight of the Rohingya or the people who were killed in Sri Lanka or the man who was killed on Facebook Live, but rather that they accept that they're huge and this sort of thing is going to happen. And they don't have, at the time when this happened, they had almost no Burmese speakers at Facebook. They had no cultural sensitivity at all. And their immediate response after that was to try to hire fact checkers, not to like send a human being there or to take responsibility. I think they've been told, and this I know, in Silicon Valley, the culture shifted dramatically in 2003, right before Facebook was started, to this libertarian notion that we're all independent actors and that we're not responsible for the consequences of what we do. And there was a law in the United States that says that internet platforms like Facebook and Google aren't responsible for what third parties do. And they believe this because, one, it's incredibly convenient, and two, that's what they've been told.
I think it's also worth noting that there are a lot of people in Silicon Valley, rich white guys like yourself, who are down for the cause of Facebook because it's going to make them a lot of money. And when you invest in a company in Silicon Valley, they're not trying to make their money back or make a profit. They want to make 50 times their money back or 100 times their money back. It's a big money trench with billions of dollars flowing, and Facebook feeds what Silicon Valley wants, which is money.
And guilty as charged. And I think it's actually worse than that. I think in the United States, we have moved from capitalism to this predatory model that basically says the only consideration is shareholder value. It used to be, inside the time period of my career, that we also valued employees. We valued the communities in which they lived. We valued the suppliers. We valued all kinds of other things. And corporations took all of those responsibilities seriously. But this notion that only the shareholder counts essentially justifies mistreating your employees, mistreating the communities they live in, and mistreating all the other constituencies in your world, the customers, the suppliers, and all of that. And I believe that is not really capitalism. That's something else. And I think we have to change all of those things. And a big part of what I'm trying to do, Joshua, is to get us back to something that would be better for everybody. Because in the system where only a fraction of 1% of the population benefits, I mean, that is not a good outcome. And history says that those things always end in conflict. And I think I would like to fix this without the conflict if we can.
Before we add one more voice to the conversation, let me get through a few of your comments. Jake tweeted, "In this day and age, there is no privacy, only the illusion of privacy." Interesting point, and that might be a good place to bring in our next guest to see, now that we hear how Facebook got to this point, where it might be going from here. Joining us from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco is Alexandra Suich Bass, Senior Correspondent of Politics, Technology, and Society at The Economist. Alexandra, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Could I ask you to start by reacting to Jake's tweet that there is no privacy, only the illusion of privacy? Is that so? And did Facebook help make it so? Or is it a little more complex than that?
Well, I think it's correct on the internet. Facebook has played a strong role in changing users' perceptions of privacy twice. As Roger mentioned earlier in the program, users felt very safe posting things on Facebook because you had to be authenticated, you used your real name, and you thought you were sharing things only with friends. Of course, that proved not to be true because Facebook had looser privacy controls than it represented to users. But people initially were very comfortable. I think now people's perceptions of privacy are changing again, this time in reverse, where Facebook has made people much more cautious about sharing things online. And I think that that backlash that we've seen start to develop is going to continue over the next few years.
Now, you've been covering Facebook for about 5 years now, as I understand it, which is ages in the tech world. 2014 was so 2014 ago. What are some of the biggest changes you've seen with Facebook since then?
I think the most important change is one of perception. I think even 2 years ago, people were talking about Mark Zuckerberg traveling around America and questioning when he would run for president of the United States and whether it could be as soon as 2020. That, of course, seems as far from a plausible reality as we can get. The question now is when he's going to next come back to Washington and testify before Congress. So I think perceptions of Facebook have radically changed in the last few years. And I think internally at Facebook, self-perception has changed. As Roger mentioned, the Facebook early on its employees and executives thought that they were an unmitigated force for good in the world and doing God's work. And I think that that has changed internally, where employees and top executives are leaving and questioning whether Facebook is as toxic as big tobacco.
I want to talk more about AI when we continue with Roger McNamee and Alexandra Suich Bass. We'll also get to some more of your questions, and we'll talk more about the future of Facebook. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to our conversation with Roger McNamee, the author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. We're also speaking to Alexandra Sewich Bass, who is a senior correspondent of politics, technology, and society for The Economist. Quick reminder, we did invite Facebook to take part, but no one responded in time for our broadcast. That invitation stands. Alexandra, one of the big scandals that befell Facebook in the last few years was the Cambridge Analytica scandal. That's where the information of 50 million Facebook users was compromised. It was a turning point in this conversation about social media and privacy. Christopher Wiley was the whistleblower on Cambridge Analytica. Here's a clip of him speaking on Facebook's role in that data breach.
I think that, you know, it was a big mistake to use this method, but why Facebook didn't, you know, make more inquiries when they started seeing that, you know, tens of millions of records were being pulled this way, I don't know. You'd have to ask Facebook that. But Facebook, at least in a technical sense, facilitated the project because they had applications that had these permissions in the first place.
That was Christopher Wiley, who blew the whistle on Cambridge Analytica. Alexandra, why would Facebook have this kind of capability built into its programming anyway? Was it an oversight? Was it intentional? Do we even know?
Facebook has obfuscated the answer to that. They, of course, this is what was revealed is entirely against their interests. They would have never wanted this scandal. What they did want was for to drive engagement. And so they were making user information available to third-party developers. The question now is what regulators are going to do about it. So we've had the Cambridge Analytica scandal is what prompted Congress to bring Mark Zuckerberg in to be grilled. It's caused a privacy backlash. We have not yet seen action, but it's entirely possible and it looks likely that what happened with Cambridge Analytica is in violation of Facebook's agreement with the Federal Trade Commission to properly reveal to users how their information is being shared and accurately represent privacy policies. So I think that we need to watch what's going to happen in Washington and whether there's going to be a large fine or further regulation after this.
Before we get to Washington, I want to come back to that in just a second, but I want to bring up a few stories that some of our listeners have shared with regards to the reach of Facebook and its ability to link people in ways that seem a little creepy. Several of you have shared stories like this one. For example, Kelsey emailed about Facebook overreach. One time I was at a concert in Washington State. I was sitting next to this lady that we became acquaintances together by the end of the concert. We exchanged names, but that was it. We lived on different sides of the state. I came home, and the next day on my Facebook, she was listed as a person that I may know. Well, we have no friends in common. We had exchanged names, and that was it. Nothing was put into my phone or hers, no phone numbers, etc. Her name that she gave me was completely different than her Facebook name. I have no idea how it happened, but I was so creeped out for months afterwards. Roger McNamee, I have had these things happen, and I know quite a few people who have had these things happen. This is exactly why we wanted Facebook on the air today, because lots of us have had these incredibly creepy encounters, and we just want to know, how the hell did you do that?
Well, so remember, they're not just getting the data off of Facebook. So they probably, for the person who was at the concert, the cell phones were in the same place at the same time. They probably knew what it was because they'd probably both purchased the concert tickets with credit cards. And there are a whole series of other databases that would have revealed that they may have come in contact. And Facebook is guessing with people you may know. When I look at my own list, most of the time, I don't know who the people are, but it's pretty obvious we've been in the same place in the same time a lot of times. And so I find all of that not only deeply creepy, but actually morally wrong. And I do think we have to set limits. There's some kinds of data and some kinds of uses that shouldn't be allowed. So, for example, Facebook was busted last week for creating a so-called research application that they circumvented Apple's App Store in order to spy on the people who use the app. Now, some of the people who use the app were minors who are clearly not in a position to make their own judgments. And so That kind of behavior is obviously excessive, and I think preying on minors has to be illegal.
And there are already challenges with minors, say, buying things in games on their parents' smartphone, or loot boxing, or that kind of thing.
That was the prior week.
Yeah.
They got busted for that. So my point here is Facebook tells us, and they've said that this week, that you know they've made all these changes. But the changes are superficial. The problems are core to the business model. And I think Facebook is a lot like a chemical company or an energy company, that they leave a lot of pollution in their wake. There are toxic spills that hurt people. And just like a chemical company, just like an energy company, when you do that, you have to be accountable and responsible economically. And I think that is the first piece of regulatory change we need to see.
Let's talk about regulation. And Alexandra, I'd love your sense of where this goes from here. That Senate hearing that Mark Zuckerberg took part in was memorable for a lot of reasons, one of which being the fact that many of the senators did not seem to know how Facebook worked. And fairly enough, there are plenty of parts of Facebook that are pretty opaque, but here's a little mashup of three senators from that hearing. Here's Orrin Hatch of Utah, Brian Schatz of Hawaii, and Deb Fischer, also of Utah.
How do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service?
Senator, we run ads.
If I'm emailing within WhatsApp, does that ever inform your advertisers?
No, we don't see any of the content in WhatsApp. It's fully encrypted.
Right, but is there some algorithm that spits out some information to your ad platform? And then, let's say I'm emailing about Black Panther within WhatsApp. Do I get a Black Panther banner ad?
So how many data categories do you store? Does Facebook store on the categories that you collect?
Senator, I'm not actually sure what that is referring to.
Alexandra, it may sound a little funny that Orrin Hatch doesn't understand that Facebook makes money on ads, but on the other hand, Facebook and its ecosystem of apps are fairly complex, and we don't really have a clear picture of exactly how they work. Where do we stand now in terms of regulation on a larger level?
Well, Washington had a lot of embarrassing moments in 2018, but I think that Senate hearing was one of the most embarrassing moments, pitting someone who knows a huge amount about data and advertising and tech against people who do not and have no idea how to regulate it. I think there are some very simple things that need to happen that can, and I think that voters should be pressuring their senators to see some of this happen in 2019. It's inevitable that we will have a privacy bill. The question is what it looks like and how strong it is. Some want to see it modeled on Europe's GDPR. California, the state of California, where I am, is pushing the envelope here because they have now their own very strong state bill.
I'm sorry, the GDPR, privacy. The General Data Protection Regulation. If you noticed
exactly.
On some websites that they give you a bunch of warnings saying, hey, we use cookies, is that okay with you? That is for those websites to comply with the GDPR.
Exactly. And that's now law in Europe. So the question is, will America adopt a law inspired by GDPR? I think it should have happened a long time ago. I think that it may well happen in 2019. Another thing that people are not talking about in America, but they should be, is how to update the merger review guidelines for big tech deals. So Facebook has achieved its competitive position by hoovering up small companies that would have grown into significant rivals. So we saw that with Instagram, which it bought for $1 billion. We saw it with WhatsApp, which it bought for $22 billion. And they were able to do this because currently the antitrust officials do not stop deals if they don't raise prices and if it's hard to show from a market share perspective
right.
That it's decreasing competition. Of course, these are such young companies that they can't step in. So I think thinking creatively about how to update those rules for the 21st century is a conversation that needs to happen in Washington.
Alexandra Sewich-Bass, senior correspondent of Politics, Technology, and Society for The Economist. Alexandra, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And Roger McNamee, the new book is called Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, and also part of a band called Moon Alice, whose music we'll be ending with today. Roger, thanks for talking to us.
It was a great pleasure.
Today's show was produced by Haley Blossingame and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit theoneA.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.